Let's all take a deep breath and close our eyes. We see in the middle of our mind a little ball of golden light, and we watch this light as it begins to grow, larger and larger, until now it covers the entire inner vision of our mind. And we see for ourselves within this light a beautiful temple. We see a garden that surrounds the temple and a body of water that flows through the garden. We see that the inside of the temple is lit as well by this same beautiful golden light. And here we are, for we have been drawn together by the power and in the presence of God. We devote our time spent together, all of our relationships and experiences together to Him. And we pray that His holiest Spirit be upon us and lift us up above and beyond all thoughts of sorrow and limitation and fear to the endless field of love that lay beyond. And so it is, together we all say, Amen. Many of us remember when Coretta Scott King and Stevie Wonder and others worked so hard year after year, congressional session after congressional session, trying to get the message out how important it was to make Martin Luther King's birthday a holiday. And I remember myself not that I was against it in any way at all, but I don't think I fully realized at the time why making his birthday a holiday was so important. But as the years go by, it is so obvious why it's important, because on this day, we think of him. And we not only think of him, but we think of the meaning of his life, and we think of the meaning of his life not only in terms of the larger narrative of American history, but also in terms of our participation in that narrative. There's a lot of whitewashing of Dr. King's legacy, a lot of, oh, let's all love each other today, let's all do national service today, but something much deeper, much grittier, and much more violent than that was going on. I think one of the basic problems that we have in the United States today is that too many of us are unaware of our history. You know, we go to therapy, we want to learn the history of our family of origin. We want to learn the history of what's it been about for gay people, what's it been about for Native Americans, what it's been about for Jews, what it's been about for black people. But there's also a way in which all of us need to connect more deeply into the story of America itself. And Dr. King's story is not only a story of black America. Dr. King's story is a story of America, particularly the relationship between black America and white America. So tonight, in order for us to most deeply understand the meaning of this holiday, not that in 1 hour we could even ever do more than just scratch the surface, let's understand the significance of the chapter of the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King's leadership of that movement and his presence within it in terms of the larger story as it has unfolded in our country, and most particularly where we are today, and what we have to do not only in order to most honor Dr. King's legacy, but also be the most conscious participants in American history at this point. Remember in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was signed. Remember, the Declaration of Independence was establishing the most enlightened principles that had ever been imbued into the Constitution, the founding documents of a country. The very idea that all men were created equal, the very idea that God gave all men unalienable rights to life and to liberty and to the pursuit of happiness, the very idea that governments were instituted among men to secure those rights. Now, all that's fantastic. At the same time, the tragic irony, the characterological dichotomy that has been with us from that moment lies in the fact that of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence, risking their lives in order to do so, because if the British had won the war, all of them would have been hanged as traitors. 41 of them were themselves slave owners. So from the very, very beginning, this dichotomy has been with us. It's baked into the cake. At the very, very beginning, on one hand, establishing the most enlightened principles of equality. On the other hand, even at the beginning, the ownership of slaves. Blacks from Africa were first brought over to the United States as slaves back in the 1600s. By the early 1800s, originally it is thought that somewhere around 400,000 originally came. By the end of the Civil War in 1865, it is estimated that there were 4 million slaves in the United States. By the beginning of the 1800s, when the cotton industry was becoming so powerful, that's when the entire slave trade began to really step up, so that you have so many people who were slaves. And of course, the Civil War was fought, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation, then the 13th Amendment, and the war was over, and slavery as an institution was abolished. Now, I do not believe the average American is racist, but I do believe the average American is woefully uneducated, undereducated, underinformed about the larger history of race in America, particularly after the Civil War. Everything that I just said, the average American knows. But what about what happened at the end of the war? At the end of the war, General Tecumseh Sherman promised every formerly enslaved agricultural worker, they were slaves, 40 acres and a mule. Now, we say that phrase almost quaint, oh, yeah, 40 acres and a mule. Well, that would have been no joke. If you were a slave, all of a sudden, not that it happened suddenly, but now you are no longer a slave. But as Martin Luther King would say, what were they freed to? Okay? Because it's not enough to just say, okay, you're free now. What are you supposed to do? How were you supposed to make a living? How were you supposed to have a life? There is a quite famous video of Dr. King speaking. It's a short video, but it says so much about this. I have it on my Facebook page right now. I have it on my Twitter right now. You see it a lot around Martin Luther King's birthday, but I suggest that you watch it because he articulates what I'm talking about tonight so eloquently. At that time, Tecumseh Sherman said, every former slave will get 40 acres and a mule, which once again would have given the formerly enslaved population an opportunity to be integrated economically into the new, into the condition of freedom. Now think about what happened here. You have an entire southern economy that was based on slavery. They did not give up slavery because they wanted to. They gave up slavery because they lost the war. Their hatred was only more intense. Their sense of revenge was only more intense. And with the stroke of a presidential pen or a constitutional amendment, you can eradicate the institution of slavery, but you could not eradicate racism. Now, remember, one of Dr. King's most famous lines was, the desegregation of the American South is the political externalization of the goal of the civil rights movement, but the ultimate goal is the establishment of the beloved community. Now, notice here, what we're talking about is the fact that there are different levels of experience. There's the external, and there is the internal. So a lot of traditional politics is like allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine is where you just treat the symptom. You seek to eradicate the symptom, to suppress the symptom. An integrative approach to healing the body is one in which it is recognized that you can't just treat the symptom, you have to treat the cause. If you don't treat the cause, as important as it is to treat the symptom, there's always the chance the symptom will morph into other forms. So with the eradication of slavery, of course, that was not the eradication of the pathology that produced it. Federal troops were stationed in the American South at the end of the war from 1865 to 1877 to ensure that the institution of slavery could not reform itself. During that time, there were former slaves, some, who were given their 40 acres and a mule. As a matter of fact, during that time, there were blacks who were elected into positions, congressional positions, etc. But many former slave owners and those of the slave owning class were really just holding their breaths until the federal troops left. Also, they were subjected to great humiliations, great difficulties, carpetbaggers coming down from the north, etc. This is one of those tragedies of history where if Abraham Lincoln had lived, I think things might have been very different. In his second inaugural, when he said, "With malice towards none, with charity for all," he wanted to treat the South not as a vanquished enemy, but as a brother who had come home. And I think if he had lived, we might have had a chance at a very different trajectory of history. As it was, he did not live, obviously. He was assassinated shortly after the end of the war. As soon as the federal troops left in the American South, they passed what were called Black Code Laws. And Black Code Laws were to ensure, they were passed by Southern legislatures, to ensure the continued subjugation of blacks in America. So follow the story here. They're no longer slaves. But now what? Okay? You're promised the 40 acres and a mule, which is essentially reparations, so that you can begin your life. But then, even those who were given it, by the time the federal troops left, in the vast majority of cases, even among those who were given it, it was taken back, the land repatriated, given back to the former slave owners who had originally owned the land. The Black Code Laws were to make sure that both economically and politically, blacks were not able to fully participate in the social realities of the American South. Ku Klux Klan, John Birch Society, You've got the federal troops left in 1877. By the end of the 1800s, lynchings in full swing. Not only lynchings of black people, lynchings of white people who would sympathize with them and try to help them. By the time the 20th century rolls around, right? So the war is over in 1865, the federal troops left in 1877. By the beginning of the 20th century, you have full-on institutionalized white supremacy codified by Southern legislators and segregation. So the violence of slavery was followed by a new phase of violence. And this lasted for 100 years. This next phase of violence against blacks was not fundamentally addressed until Dr. King and the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Think about this. The war is over in 1865. By the end, so you've got 35 years, right, before the end of that century, and then from 1900 on, and the horrors of lynchings, of Jim Crow laws, of segregation. There was what was called the Great Migration. Many blacks who couldn't live, they couldn't find a way to live in the South, they made the Great Migration into cities like Detroit and Cleveland and other places like that, where in many cases, even in the northern cities, they were met with racial prejudice. In the 1960s, this is why. This is to give you some historical context of what Dr. King was addressing and what the level and the strength of the resistance against what Dr. King was trying to do. Dr. King was a Baptist preacher. Dr. King went to India. He studied the principles of nonviolence as articulated by Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi had articulated the principles of nonviolence as a way of getting the British out of India. Dr. King brought the principles of nonviolence back to the United States to apply to the struggle for civil rights here in the 1960s. Now, the whole concept of the philosophy of nonviolence is that if you take on institutional forms of evil, slavery is evil. The higher consciousness community needs to stop pussyfooting around that word. If you only take on external forms of evil and of injustice on an external level, you can't beat it. The idea of nonviolence, we all know Dr. King's statements that hate cannot drive out hate, only love can drive out hate. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. And as Dr. King said, Mahatma Gandhi was the first person who took the love ethic and turned it into a broad-scale social force for good. So what Gandhi said, and then Dr. King rearticulated and applied himself here in the United States, was that love could be used as a political tool. Love could be used as a political tool. So what Dr. King said is that this is sewn up. If all we keep trying to do is to strategize on an external level to dismantle segregation, it will not work. What we must do, he said, is to arouse the conscience of a nation. And that was the message of the civil rights movement. So when Dr. King said, the political externalization. So you've got the external level. That's what we needed to do. We needed to dismantle segregation. So that's the political externalization, he said. But the ultimate goal is the establishment of the beloved community. Because unless and until there is the establishment of the beloved community, then these symptoms will continue to morph into new forms. In 1964 and 1965, first there was the Civil Rights Act, and in the Civil Rights Act, there was the dismantling of the methodologies of segregation having to do with discrimination in the workplace and so forth. The next year was the Voting Rights Act. Now, this is extremely important about the Voting Rights Act. Throughout the American South, there were all kinds of ways to ensure that blacks could not vote. Now, this is where we start to have an understanding of how the job's not only not done, but as Barack Obama pointed out when he was just about the time when he was leaving the White House, he pointed out that history doesn't always move in a straight line. Sometimes it's two steps forward and one step back. Every American should realize that in 2013, the John Roberts Supreme Court started gutting, chipping away at the Voting Rights Act that was passed in the mid-60s, which is exactly why all the voter suppression efforts are abounding in the United States today. They're back. Now, as Dr. King said, we need more than to just not, you know, it was such a big deal that people could vote and that their voting rights were protected. It was such a big deal that discrimination in the workplace in various places had been abolished on an external plane. However, I think we would all agree that Dr. King's claim is as true today as it was then, and I hope that you will watch that video, which is that full economic integration into the larger society of the United States had not yet been achieved. In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president. And when he was elected president, he had a domestic advisor who later became a senator from New York named Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan suggested what he called a period of benign neglect. And benign neglect towards black people was that Moynihan said to Nixon, you know what, the 60s have been so tumultuous, we all need to calm down. We've had too much of this stuff going on with the Vietnam War, with the Civil Rights Movement, so let's now practice towards black people a period of what he called benign neglect, which was basically no more continuing trying to do stuff. We won't proactively try to harm them, but we won't necessarily be trying to help them either. Benign neglect. And so I would ask you, if you have kicked someone down, if you've kicked someone to the ground, obviously you owe it to them to stop kicking. Do you not owe it to them to say, here, let me help you get back up? That is a question that is as relevant to Americans today as it was in the 1960s. In 1945, when the Holocaust was over, two generations later, a generation of Germans began to be cognizant of the various levels of debt owed to the Jewish people after the Holocaust. Since that time, the Germans have paid $89 billion to Jewish organizations as reparations. In 1988, Ronald Reagan signed American Civil Liberties Act, in which 100,000 people who had been interned in the Japanese internment camps in World War II were given $22,000 each. By the 20th century, reparations from one people who have wronged another people was simply considered the civilized thing to do. We'd all like to think that we live in a post-racial society, and in many ways, things have absolutely improved. There are many things that we can look at that make it very, very obvious that race relations in the United States have improved. At the same time, there are many ways in which race relations in the United States are sliding backwards and even getting worse. Mass incarceration, obvious racial disparity in criminal sentencing, and so forth. That is why, on a day like today, we need to be doing more than looking back. Because the narrative of American history is like a novel, and every generation writes its part in the novel. And it's our generation's turn. Now, I'm going to be talking to you a lot about that in the next year. But in terms of race in America, there is no more seething, festering wound than this one. It is like a primary site of cancer. Everything that we see happening at the southern border, everything that is so obviously racist, having to do with brown people at the border, having to do with a ban against Muslims, the deeper question, as we know, has to do with the entire idea of Anglo-Saxon ownership. The very idea that people come to this continent, which has been inhabited for thousands of years by Native Americans anyway, it's like you steal a house and then you put a "we moved" sign up in front. And that is the deeper question that Americans are asking themselves or should be asking ourselves. And every question has underneath it a deeper spiritual question. And that has to do with whether we are one or not. You've heard me talk so many times about how the Course in Miracles says you are one. On the level of the body, you are separate. And on the level of the body, we glory in the fact that the United States is diverse. It has always been, until very recently, without question, at least theoretically, that we gloried in the fact that we're a nation of immigrants. We gloried in e pluribus unum, out of many. We don't want to diminish our diversity. And many of us look at the fact that, wow, we're different colors, and different sexualities, and different religions, and different everything. How cool is that? Some of us look at that and go, wow, this is so cool. Wow, 50 years from now, this could be so amazing. And other people look at that and go, oh, no, 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 that's not amazing at all. This is exactly what was present in 1776. It is the same dichotomy. Over and over and over again. There is nothing new about what is going on. But it is taking a particularly vicious form in our time. Now, former generations have looked and said, oh, no, 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 we're going to push back against that. So there was slavery, but then there was abolition. There was the suppression and the oppression of women, but then there was feminism and women's suffrage. There was segregation and institutionalized white supremacy, and then there was the civil rights movement. It's our turn. And in every single area where we are seeing that old archetype And it is more than an archetype, because it is an archetype that embodies itself. It is an archetype that takes very real forms in the lives of human beings and forms actual evil iterations. When you look at something like the injustices of mass incarceration, so many of the racial injustices that we see in the United States today, these are real people. These are real people suffering in ways that in the United States, it is everything that we stand for to seek to address. No American with any knowledge of history has any pretense that we have ever fully actualized all that we say that we are. America doesn't claim that we have made it. But the point of the sheer morality of the claim is that in every generation we try. That is why Dr. King matters. That is why Dr. King was saying, we're not asking for new rights. We're here to cash a check. Dr. King said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. It's not only about what happens to blacks or to Jews or to Japanese or to Native Americans. Sometimes these days we're a little bit too caught up in what happens to any one particular siloed group and not cognizant enough, not deep enough in our consideration of what is happening to all of us. And so I believe, for instance, that just as the nation of Germany paid $89 billion in reparations to Jewish organizations, just as we paid the $22,000 to every surviving person who had been enslaved in the Japanese internment camp, not enslaved, but interned in the internment camps during World War II, I'm one of those people, and I hope that there will be more and more, and in my campaign I will be talking about it. It is time for our generation. Enough is enough with these small random acts of kindness. We need some huge strategized acts of deep love. We need a plan. We need a plan of reparations for slavery. We need $100 billion given over a period of 10 years, $10 billion a year, to a council of esteemed African-American leaders from culture, from academia, from politics, who would be given $10 billion a year over 10 years to disperse to the projects for economic renewal and educational renewal that they feel best does the job to in any way level the playing field. Germany cannot make the Holocaust not have happened, but paying those reparations went far, if nothing else, towards the respect given to acknowledge that a debt is owed. It is time for the United States to do the same. We cannot make slavery not have happened, but we can stop the insult. We can admit there is a debt to be paid, and we can do what we can in our time to pay it. Otherwise, Dr. King becomes what too often dead people become, what they do not wish to be in death. The whole point of the resurrection is that there is no death. The body can die, but the spirit cannot. And if we make people who have passed this way and have already left into these cardboard figures and we dress them up, it's like what we do with the Statue of Liberty. Give me your hungry, give me your poor. We dress her up, we make her pretty. We don't listen to a word she says anymore. It is time to bring to life these things. When it comes to these principles that all men are created equal, when it comes to principles like all men are endowed by God with unalienable rights of life and of liberty and the pursuit of happiness, it's not enough if these principles are just our marble walls. It's not enough that they're just on parchment. They have to be alive in our hearts or they lose their moral force. In the Jewish religion, it is said that every generation must rediscover God for itself. And every generation of Americans has to rediscover the audacity of democracy, the radicalism of democracy. It is radical to say all men are created equal. It is radical to say all men are given by God, ladies and gentlemen, by God, unalienable rights of life and of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And it is ignorant to pretend or to avoid the fact or to in any way ignore that there are not forces throughout history as active today as there have always been, who count on our forgetting it, who count on our ignoring it, who count on our being so distracted by ultimately unimportant things that we are willing to allow the thieves of our democracy to take our most precious principles from us. And I'll be talking a lot about that next week, because it's time for Americans to rise up, because the thieves are at the door. They might not be at your door, but if you live in certain neighborhoods, it's obvious that they are at your door. This is why we don't have health care. This is why so many Americans don't have universal health care. It's why so many Americans have a difficult time getting an education, et cetera. We don't have to go into those specifics tonight. But tonight, on the night of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, let us remember what he said on the day that he died. If you've never been to the Lorraine Motel, been to the museum there, I suggest that you might want to make a visit there someday. And you know, he said to his lieutenants, Jesse Jackson and others, he called them into his hotel room, and he said, let's have a meeting. And we all know from the speech he gave the night before, we all know about Dr. King's premonition. We all know that he said he had been to the mountaintop. He might not get there with you, he said, but he has seen it. He knew what was going to happen. He knew on some level of his soul. But when he brought his lieutenants together, he didn't know the day, he didn't know the hour, but he knew what was probably coming. And when he, in his last meeting, when he brought his lieutenants together, he did not say, okay, let's go over strategy again. That's not what he said. He said, okay, let's go over the principles of nonviolence one more time. Those principles of nonviolence, which have to do with realizing that, as Dr. King said, there is a power in us more powerful than the power of bullets. It ultimately does not matter who has the money, who has the technology, who has the business, and who has the governmental power. There was no way that the early evangelicals and the early Quakers who formed the abolitionist movement, there is no way it could have been considered reasonable to abolish slavery. There is no way that for the early suffragettes it would have been considered reasonable to think that they could gain the right to vote for women. There was no way that Dr. King and others involved in the civil rights movement thought it was reasonable to think that they could actually dismantle segregation in the American South. You don't do what's reasonable, you do what's right. That is the moral issue of living a meaningful life. You don't think just in terms of what's going to build your career. You don't just think in terms of brand protection. You don't just think in terms of what would be fun. You don't just think in terms of your own pain. You think about the right thing to do. That is what Dr. King stood for, and that is what Dr. King died for. And in the Course in Miracles, it says, I am not looking for martyrs. I am looking for teachers. Let me tell you something. The people who are the most vicious today, not in their personal attitudes, but in their behavior. And this is extremely important, and we will be talking about more about this the next year. The people who are the true opponents of our democracy today, it's nothing personal. It's just that democracy is inconvenient to their economic purposes. It is that cold. It is that sociopathic. It is really nothing personal. But the point is, the power represented by the money and the power represented by the technology, and the power represented by governments, when government has become, as it has today, a handmaiden to those corporate conglomerates who represent those financial interests, that is nothing when the people of the United States and the people of the world are awake. That is the message of nonviolence. That was the message of Gandhi, and that is the message of Martin Luther King. There is a power in us more powerful than the power of bullets. You just keep marching, Dr. King said. You just keep walking. And it doesn't matter who says you're crazy. And it doesn't matter who says it can't be done. And it doesn't matter what kind of forces are arrayed against you. You are not speaking to what is possible. You are speaking to the ages. And Dr. King not only spoke to the ages, but in speaking to the ages, we rise. And when you rise, your wings begin to form. And you begin to fly at a higher altitude. And you begin to speak at a higher frequency. And you begin to live at a higher plane. And you begin, as the Course in Miracles says, to attract mighty companions for what you aspire. And what you aspire to, and what you yearn for, and what you hope for, and what you hope for your children, is the same thing that everybody else you know is hoping for and aspiring to and praying for their children. It is what billions and billions and billions of people are hoping for, that we might live on a planet where there is peace, where we might live on a planet where people have a fair shot, and where this country is a place where, to the best of our ability, we show up in our time to do what other generations have done in theirs. And that is to lay claim to the vision of what's possible. That's what Dr. King did. He laid claim to the vision of what's possible. For all of you here in Los Angeles and all of you who are looking, what have we been doing for the last 35 years except laying claim to what's possible for your career, laying claim to what's possible for your relationships, laying claim to what's possible for your money? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to lay claim for what's possible in this country and on this planet Earth. Since I was a little girl, I loved to read biographies. When I was a little girl, there were these books, and I remember that they were green, and they had people's names, and then they would be surrounded in these yellow squiggly lines. Ever since I was a little girl, I had a thing about biographies. Because when you read history, and you just read, you know, this happened on this date, and this happened on that date, kind of like they teach it in school, it's dry, it's disconnected, you don't understand the relevance. But when you read the biographies, when you read about Lincoln, when you read about Jefferson, when you read about Alice Paul, when you read about Susan B. Anthony, when you read about Dr. King, when you read about all the people throughout history, in the arts, in politics, in philosophy, who have done great things, you don't read about people who were perfect. You don't read about people who had no pain. You don't read about people who didn't have sometimes barriers in their lives and obstructions in their lives and difficulties in their lives. You think about someone like Thoreau. You know, we all love Thoreau and Walden and on Walden Pond. The man died at 44 because he was working in a pencil factory, in his family's pencil factory, and he got lead poisoning. Louisa May Alcott died of arsenic that they gave her because they thought that this was what they were supposed to give to women who were depressed from their period. And they would take it, and they thought that when you had had enough that you were foaming at the mouth, that's when you had taken enough, but actually that's when you were taking enough that you were killing yourself. You read these things and you think of people who have achieved, and then you look at us. What are we doing? We're acting like we're porcelain dolls. None of us. We do not have time to get over our trauma work before we show up for our country. There are sometimes the people in my life who have helped me the most sometimes have been the people who put their arms around me and told me that it would be okay and have been kind to me. And there are other times, and sometimes it's the same people who say, get up, get back out there, you will not be felled by this. And that's what all of us need to remember. And that is what Dr. King said to his people, we will not be felled by this. I had the honor of knowing Coretta Scott King. And in, I guess, 2000, it was not too long after 9/11. So I don't, that was in September. So it was probably 2002. It was Dr. King's birthday celebration. And I had the great honor of Coretta Scott King asking me to give the talk that day for the celebration, Dr. King's birthday, at Ebenezer Baptist Church on his pulpit. And I was so honored and I was so excited. And it was right after 9/11, and I planned to give my speech about George Bush's policies after 9/11 in relation to Dr. King. So you know me well enough that you can only imagine what I was planning to say. I went to the church there in Atlanta, and I was sitting in a room waiting, and I expected to be brought in. I don't think that I had met Coretta before then, I don't believe. Maybe I had met her maybe once or twice. And a gentleman came in to take me to meet her, and I was all ready, and these were his words. "Miss Williamson, are you ready to come meet Mrs. King and Mrs. Bush now?" "All right, Miss Feminist. All right, Miss Nonviolent Feminist. How are you going to do with the woman who sleeps with them every night right behind you?" And I didn't have much time to prepare. I started praying rather hard. It's a good thing that I didn't have time to prepare, because I was living in that place that we all live in. How can I not sacrifice my truth? How can I lay down what I think needs to be laid down, but at the same time be nonviolent? At the same time be nonviolent. And this is what happened, because I wasn't even having a chance to consciously plan it. But what I would do, Mrs. Bush and Mrs. King were sitting here on these two chairs, right? About like, you know, like this. And then I'm up here at the lectern. And so every time I would be about to speak about the president, I turn around and, "Mrs. Bush, we are praying for your husband at this very difficult time." And then I turn back around and say what I wanted to say. But the fact that I just said, "We're praying for your husband at this very difficult time," it wasn't just words, and I was on a pulpit. Let me tell you what happened at the end of my talk. At the end of my talk, I went to shake hands with Mrs. King, to shake hands with Mrs. Bush, and I went into this like a little girl afraid that I'd done the wrong thing and mommy would be mad at me. And I just started, and I looked at her, and I started to apologize. I said, "I hope I didn't. By the way, I don't know if it was 2002. Maybe it was 2003. I'm not sure. But anyway, I went, and I started to almost like apologize, and this is what Laura Bush did. Because, you know, she used to be an elementary school teacher. And she went, "Shh." And she put her finger to my lips, and she went, "Shh, you did good." She's no idiot. She knew where she was that day. She knew where she was, and she saw that I tried. She saw that I tried to practice what the whole point of all this was. And I have to say that that moment, standing there with Coretta Scott King and Laura Bush, it is a memory that is frozen in my brain. Because in that moment, it wasn't about the externals. We were three women. We met in that place that Gandhi said politics should be. He said politics should be sacred. The fact that we sought goodwill towards each other. Without that, it means nothing. And without that, we will not arouse the conscience of a nation. So let's be very, very clear. Dr. King didn't pussyfoot around what was true. And Dr. King was not always appreciated in his time, obviously, because not only the violence that was perpetrated against everything starting back from slavery, really, if you see the entire lineage of it, but also during the civil rights movement, church bombings, etc., obviously was perpetrated against him. Many people, for those of you who do not know, one of the theories about Dr. King's death, and I think it's certainly worth considering, there are those who felt that if he had only talked about race, he might not have met the fate that he met. It was when he began to use his voice, a larger panoply of topics, including the war in Vietnam, U.S. militarism in general, that it seemed as though his fate was sealed. None of this is new, in other words. None of this is new. This drama is not new, and this drama is not over. So let us not look back on a night like tonight at Dr. King and think of him as only a memory. We do not show honor to his memory by putting it in this box and talking about how wonderful it is, and we should all do service today. That is the way we cheapen the memory. In Course in Miracles, when Jesus says, "Show that I did not die, teach that I did," he said, "teach that I did not die. teach that I did not die. The Course in Miracles says there is no death. Life itself cannot be destroyed. Dr. King's body could be destroyed, just like everyone's body will one day pass from this earth. But ideas themselves do not die as long as they are held alive in our hearts. The message of Dr. King was a message that did not just have to do with his people at his time. He was a world historic figure because in speaking to the reality of the drama and the evil and the injustice that was suffered by black people in America, he was speaking to the larger drama of injustice that has been with us throughout time. Here in the United States, Dr. King knew we could do better, we should do better, and we can do better. In his time, because he lived, because he struggled, because of those he gathered around him, they did do better, and they did move this country forward. And Dr. King was hardly a naive man. Dr. King would, I don't think, as heartbroken as he would be, I don't think he would be surprised to see some of the ways in which we've slipped backwards. But, you know, I used to always think, I still do, that even though with most people, every year after they die, it gets a little bit better. With Dr. King and with Martin Luther, and with Bobby Kennedy and others, it's like every year that passes after their deaths, it's even more depressing because of so many ways in which everything we feared would happen indeed has happened. But I've been saying for the last few years that Martin Luther King's birthday. Martin Luther King now would be an old man. Even if Dr. King were alive today, it would be time for us to say, Martin, even if he was on a rocking chair with his grandbabies, it would be time for us to say, Martin, you rest. We'll take it from here. He's not alive to hear us, but wherever he is, let him hear us now. Martin, you rest. We will take it from here. Thank you very, very, very much. Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you. Dr. King said, we need a beloved community. In order to achieve that, he said, we need a quantitative shift in our circumstances and a qualitative shift in our souls. We've talked tonight about some of the quantitative shifts, such as reparations and so forth, that need to happen. We've talked about mass incarceration, racial disparity in sentencing, all of these things that are so important and significant in our history today. But now let us think about the spiritual purification that is necessary, that is an absolute essential aspect of the philosophy of nonviolence. The guns in our own heads, the attack thoughts, and we all have them. Especially towards those who disagree with us. So from the perspective of nonviolence, we have to do more than try to make things happen differently on the outside. We have to be open to change on the inside. And so let's take this opportunity to give to God all those barriers we hold against love's coming. The Course in Miracles says it's not your job to seek for love, but to seek within yourself all the barriers you hold against its coming. The character defects, the little things we do, the way we think, the way we talk, the way we act. Places where we know we're not quite who we could be yet. And spirit can only use us to the extent to which we are vessels prepared for use. So our own engagement, our own willingness to rise up, our own willingness to think about some things that are not easy to think about, that are not fun to think about, but that we must look at and think about, and to think about deeply and seriously in order to be conscious citizens of the world at this time. Everything that we need to be told, everything that we need to know, we will be shown, but we're not practiced listeners. That's why we meditate. That's why we take time for that inner listening. Mahatma Gandhi said that the leader of the Indian independence movement was the small, still voice within. So let's listen to the small, still voice within. What Dr. King accomplished was so extraordinary. And there were those who said it was impossible. There's a book called The Testament of Hope, his collected speeches and writings. If you don't have that, it's a great book just to have to open anywhere, at any, you know, just to open it anywhere. His eloquence in addition to his brilliance. And the letter from a Birmingham jail, of course, is one of the most famous. The letter from a Birmingham jail was a response to some ministers and priests and rabbis who had said to him, basically, Martin, you need to slow down. We support you. We want everything that you want, but you have to take these changes incrementally. And he gives in that letter the most brilliant repudiation of incrementalism. Because he says if you just make a little change here and a little change there, then the status quo will always co-opt. You have to go for the impossible. You have to go for the impossible. So let's ask in our own hearts tonight, where do we cower? Where are we less than we should be? Where are we not rising to the occasion? Where are we coddling fear? Where are we coddling our woundedness? Where are we more patient with ourselves? Sometimes it's so important to be patient with yourself. And then sometimes there's a level of divine impatience that's called for. I remember a woman saying to me once at one of my lectures, what should I do about, and she mentioned this pattern with men. And based on everything that I knew, everything that I'd been through, and everything I'd been through with other people, I finally had come up with the answer, and the answer was this. Just stop it. Just stop it. At a certain point, it's time. So let's close our eyes. And let us, as we have closed our outer eye, open to the light which is within. And here in this sacred place, we seek the wisdom and the illumination and the glory of God. Here in this field of peace, in this space of God which is closer than every breath we take, God's power always with us from here unto eternity. Let us bow and devote our lives to that which is holy and that which is good and that which is true, and that which is love. On this night, we join with millions of people in this country and around this world in giving honor, in giving thanks, in giving praise to the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King, and his wife, and all those who worked with him and struggled with him and sacrificed with him. A And we take into our hands the continued journey towards justice in America and in the world. And we surrender ourselves to the task of furthering the great work in our time. We ask God to take from us all the littleness, the grandiosity, the self-centeredness, the weakness, anything in our hearts, in our minds, or in our behavior, any circumstance, any relationship. We know that you know us, dear God, even better than we know ourselves. Take from us anything that stands between who we are and you. And as we stand naked before God, all weakness dissolves. All smallness falls away. And we inhabit the space, the Christ, the Shekinah, the Buddha mind, that golden light that is who we truly are. In this place, in this moment, we are strong, for we are one with God. We are good, for we are one with God. We are innocent, for we are one with God. And we are one with each other, for we are one with God. Having given praise and thanks for the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, remembering him on this night for leading his people to the promised land, knowing that the promised land's boundaries must be ever expanded, in dedication to that justice in this country and in this world, we pray that we too might be used. As we pray, dear God, send me. Use me. Assign me. For thus we shall know the glory of being used for something higher than ourselves. We shall know the satisfaction of significance, the fierceness of relevance, and the joy of being used by love. May our prayers and the prayers of so many others on this night create a wave of peace and love for Dr. King and all the regions of the cosmos. And may the voice of love that he so mightily shouted from the rooftops be a voice that remains in us. So great is God, who has told us that moving mountains is small compared to what we can do. Dr. King, having moved a few, may we now move some more. To this we dedicate this night and our lives. And so it is. Together, we all say, amen.